Okay, so, a continuation and that, I'm sorry, the population of students decreased, population of professors increased, but the lecture is still addressed for students. So, this is the reminder paradoxes.
Any good professor knows that he or she is still a student.
I was gonna say too.
Just saying.
Yeah, I know.
I think that was like, whatever.
That was the Russian version of whatever.
I will keep all my comments with me. This Loschmidt paradox is the idea that all molecular mechanics properties are completely reversible in time. And if we imagine a very, very, very big computer and we run complete computer molecular dynamics simulation of everything, let's say in the universe, every atom of water and everything, and at some point we stop the computer and reverse the directions of velocities of all particles in the system, then presumably this will run backwards and will trace all microscopic jiggles and wiggles of every atom in the system. How then is in agreement with the statement that macroscopic dynamics is irreversible and leads to some dissociation. I don't think this paradox in general is completely resolved. And there are some subtleties which are still unclear, at least unclear to me. But at least part of the resolution is the fact that when the system is not very big and it's not observed for a very long time, then there is a chance that counterintuitive events will happen, such as very tiny little cell-sized coffee cup can start warming up on the expense of surrounding water rather than normal situation which we are all used to when coffee only evaporates and cools down. So I told you about one fluctuation theorem, which tells you how likely it is to observe such a counterintuitive event. And now I will tell you another fluctuation theorem, which belongs to Crookes, Hagen Crookes. And it is 1999. So it's interesting. I'm trying to indicate all the years to the best of my memory, because it's interesting that this whole subject went through, I would say, two periods of heated interest. One period was at the beginning of statistical mechanics, the end of 19th century, and the other was when people realized how this is all related to single molecule experiments and new modern biological physics. So between, there were some developments, but those are two big peaks, so it's interesting historical aspect. So I will illustrate this Crookes relation using the following example. Suppose you have RNA molecule, a relatively short RNA molecule whose sequence is such that it forms this type of structure. Big RNAs, such as viral RNAs, they form a complicated assembly of many such loops. And it's interesting physics. I'm just writing, in the middle of writing a paper about bio-RVs and how they behave, but it's not the point. My point is, so this is, suppose this is equilibrium structure. We consider such conditions of temperature, salinity, and ionic strength, and so on, that this is equilibrium. And now imagine that what we do is we attach optical feeder, attach some colloidal particles to the ends of this RNA. And I will draw it like this. Although, keep in mind that in reality, when people attach the colloidal particles to the ends of a molecule like this, the picture is not like this. The size of this particle is not a little piece compared to RNA. The size of this particle is roughly to the end of the black. Okay? And there is another elephant like that on this side. But the idea, nevertheless, is you can apply forces, controlled forces, to the end. And then, through these forces, you can force your RNA to unfold like this. Well, it's an idealized picture. In reality, it still wiggles somehow in the middle of something like that. So, okay, so now I want to address the following question. As I pull this thing up, I perform work and open this up. I resist. I pull hard, I work hard. What is the probability that because of some strange molecular events, the heats of water molecules will cooperate such that instead of me performing work, the heat bus will work on me, will give me energy. What is the chance that I will benefit from it? Is it possible to collect this energy, to sell it instead of, I don't know what is, California Energy Company, New York, I think it's called Edison, so we can sell this energy and benefit from it. What is the chance that this will happen? That's the question that I want to address. Of course, this would contradict, well, not contradict first law of thermodynamics. It's not violation of energy conservation. Energy is conserved. I'm planning to gather energy which is there in water. And I can tell you, such suggestions keep popping up in literature. I recently was a referee of a paper for Physical Review, which suggested that we will do it on the expense of energy which is abundant in water. So it's something sort of. So, if anything, it is a question of second law of thermodynamics. From that point of view, let's call this distance r. And let's just see what happens. If we do our experiment very, 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 very slowly, then there will be some, I don't know what, some curves. And eventually it will break. So then, if I take force times delta r and do the sum, this will be this area, and this is work. This is the work that I have to perform to break it. If this is, if I do it very, very, very slow, but if I be careful enough, then of course I will have to apply more force because among other things, I am probably working to get friction and so on, so I perform more work. Now, this is the ideal case. This is textbook case. Of course, the concept of ideality, ideal for whom? We'll discuss this philosophy. And this is a real case. So, real work is always greater than ideal work. And ideal work is the same as the change in free energy of the system. So what, if I repeat this experiment many, many times, what is the probability distribution of this quantity, which is real work, which I will call big W? So this is second law of thermodynamics. This inequality is nothing else but the second law of thermodynamics. So I will now repeat this experiment many, many times and ask what is the probability distribution of this quantity W. It will be different for different realizations of this experiment. If the experiment was on something macroscopic, then we will have all the time on the same work, but in single molecule life, it's some probability distribution. So if you plot it, there will be some average. And there will be some probability that you will perform too much work. And that does not violate this large work case, does not violate second law. But there is a tail in a different direction, and in principle, this W can even be negative. So this part does violate second law. Okay. So what is this W? So one aspect to it, strictly the violation starts if this work is smaller than delta F. So this is delta F. And the probability that this work equals delta F minus some amount of zeta. The probability that we violate second law by the amount zeta. This is e to minus zeta over kBT. Well, as somebody told me previous time, this is sort of trivial. That to violate it by any large amount is very improbable. It is true, I agree on this level. it is sort of trivial, but the fact that it is again the same Boltzmann exponent, not some other function or not anything else, this is interesting. Here is another statement, even more general statement, about this probability distribution of W. So I think I will have to explain it a little better. Let me call this initial state A, and this stretch state B. Then I will, in my notation, I will emphasize that what I do is I go from A to B, and on the way perform work W. What is the probability that I will perform the work W on my way from A to B? Now I want to emphasize that although A is in equilibrium state here, B doesn't have to be in equilibrium state. I am not suggesting that I will wait here for a very, very long time until this thing equilibrates at this new force. This is not just an equilibrium state. Okay, then I want to introduce the idea of the reverse experiment. The idea seems easy, but I will tell you that there are subtleties here. The reverse experiment on the surface of things would be to take this, to reduce the force, and allow the system to relax back to this. This will be P. B to A. This is the reverse. So this is forward process. And this is the reversed. But there is an important subtlety here. The important subtlety is that when I consider a reverse process, then I assume that B is equilibrium. And A is not. Let me try to explain it better. The way to explain it would be the following. I will show the track line of my experiment. So from minus infinity to some initial time, the system was relaxing at zero force. I did not apply any force. So this is force and the function of time. Here, before, the force was zero. Then, at this time point, I started applying some force. And I did it in some particular manner. I had some protocol. I increased force in some way. Increased, decreased, doesn't matter. I can do whatever I like. This is called protocol. Okay? Then, this is my A. This is my B. At this point, I did not wait until the system equilibrates. So this is the end of my forward drop. And here I measure the work W. But then, what happens is I wait for potentially very long time, for as long as it needed for the system to equilibrate at this value of force. I keep my force and wait, week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, one medicine, two medicines. In this case, it depends. For RNA, it may only take a second. But as a matter of principle, I have to wait until it's equilibrated. And then, at this point in time, my B is equilibrated. I am stretched, my RNA is stretched. But it is equilibrated in the stretched state. And then what I do is I start a reverse protocol. So now comes the challenge for me. I have to draw this line backwards. I don't know how well I did it, but by the time I arrive to A, the force is already zero, but RNA did not relax yet. Okay, and I do not wait until it relaxes. And this is my forward protocol. And this is my reverse protocol.
What do we mean that the RNA is not relaxed?
Sorry?
What do you mean by equilibrium here?
What do I mean by equilibrium? Okay, very good question, thank you. When force is large, there is some equilibrium distribution of wiggles of this RNA. It's more or less stretched, but it doesn't mean it's stretched like a ruler. It is wiggly, and it's wiggles. There are some waves which run back and forth. So this whole ensemble of different waves and different wiggles, this ensemble, whole ensemble, is equilibrium. This is thermodynamic equilibrium. This is not mechanical equilibrium. This is statistical equilibrium. All sorts of fluctuations are settled. Similarly, this state is equilibrium, but it does not necessarily mean that it is always static like this. For instance, this stem can turn back and forth. This thing can rotate a little bit like that, and so on. So this state in equilibrium samples all conformations that it likes. And the rule of the game is that I keep my force zero here until RNA equilibrates it at this state, the sample source state. Then I increase my force. Do not wait any second, and only consider this protocol and measure the work that I perform during this time. Then I keep my force at large value, constant, for indefinite amount of time until stretch state equilibrates. All sorts of wiggles come in and come out and so on. And then I go back down here and measure the work here. So this is forward protocol and this is the reverse protocol. Yes.
So is your point that you don't necessarily return to A, because if you just, once the force stops, it may not have actually relaxed into this loop. It has zero force, but it may still be doing something else at the time.
Yes. I don't know how to introduce better notation, but by A, I mean the value of force at the beginning. Here, maybe better to write something like P from F equals zero and equilibrium to F greater than zero and no conditional equilibrium. Okay, is that better notation? It's better than let's use this one. And in this sense, this is P, the probability to have certain work starting from F greater than zero and equilibrated, and coming to F equals zero, and not necessarily equilibrated. So the statement by Mr. Crookes, and you see it took me half an hour to formulate, but that's, I think, useful. The statement by Mr. Crookes is this. And now I return to my shorthand notation from which I started. Imagination how data should look like. They pretty much look like that. Yes. This is W. This is forward. And then there is another curve, actually the set of curves for different conditions, more or less like this, and this is backward.
This what is the y-axis?
Say again?
What is the y-axis?
Probability is p. This P, so one curve is this P which is upstairs, and another curve is the P which is downstairs. And the place where you should look like, should look, is where these two cross. When they cross, that means this thing is one, that means this thing is zero, and you just read out from here your delta. Yes.
I have two questions. So the first one is, for the reverse case, the P in the beginning, it's like F greater than zero, but that just means it's holding, right? It's not pulling on it. So that still means, I mean, I can pull it up and then you're just holding?
What do you mean? Holding and not pulling. It reminds me
the in statement your about the... In your experiment, you're you have the... In the beginning, you pull up the RNA, which means you're increasing the force, right? And then you're holding it steady there?
No, it doesn't mean I increase the force.
Applying the force.
I apply the force. Yes. In my drawing, it looks like the force increases. It does not.
No, it does not increase. You just apply it and then it unfolds. But while it's in the up plateau, you hold the force, and that's why the force is greater than zero.
Hold the force.
And that's why it's greater than zero in that.
It's a constant which is greater than zero. I hold the force. Doesn't mean that the ends stay fixed. Ends can fluctuate.
Yes.
But the force is fixed.
The force is fixed, and it's greater than zero. Okay.
I think Rob would like me to draw it like this. If you have your RNA here and your optical tweezers here, then of course you have some strings, some pulleys, and you have. Those are. Now the force is fixed.
And then the second question was in the law that you wrote with the two probabilities.
Yes.
Why is it minus the W?
That is because, of course, when you work in different directions, then it's typically, for instance, with this force, you in forward protocol, you increase your x, you move in this direction. In the reverse protocol, you move in that direction. So therefore, your work gets different size. That's very easy. This is easy question.
So, where is the zero pointing in this x-axis?
What is zero in this axis? Mm-hmm. It's zero work. What zero work means?
Yeah.
Zero work means that this area is zero. That means you did something like this. That means sometimes during some part of your time you were pulling, and for some period of time all these water molecules, heating water molecules, cooperated such that they were pushing from you. Total work is zero.
This back curve is W or minus W?
This is, okay. It is this quantity, P of minus W.
So the free energy difference is the free energy difference between zero force at equilibrium and non-zero force at equilibrium.
Excellent question. Yes, this is my next thank you. This is a good lead to my next point. This is mysterious statement, and I will derive for you even more mysterious statement, and I will return to in a second to this. So let's rearrange my formula a little bit. Even comment about this, it's just simple algebra transformation, and then let us integrate both sides over W. And what I have on the left is average value of T to minus W over KBT. So that means you perform forward experiments, don't worry about backward experiments, you perform forward experiments many times, measure average, not average work, but average exponential of the work. And on this side, this gives you 1 because this is normal like probability and there is nothing else. So it gives you minus e to minus delta f over e. So this is called Jagzinski relation. And I call this, usually I call this, I will even write this down on the blackboard. So this is the simplest general correct formula, not in Landau in Lipschitz. This, I think, is a very interesting phenomenon.
Any Landau Lipschitz?
Huh?
Any of the Landau Lipschitz?
Any of them. Okay. It's exception to the 10 volumes of Landau Lipschitz. No. And it will, of course, take 5 seconds for Landau to drag. And maybe 5 hours for Lipschitz to drag. But just didn't occur to them to ask question in this very form, because this became relevant with the advent of single molecule experimentation and such things. It just never occurred to them to think in that direction. So why it is mysterious? It is mysterious because you do a bunch of forward protocol experiments. In none of them, you wait until the thing equilibrates at large force. You do your experiments many, many times. You do average, and somehow mysteriously, you learn about free energy, which is purely equilibrium property. So you do many non-equilibrium experiments, and from them you learn something about the equilibrium, which is a mystery if you take it for face value. But the resolution of that mystery is very simple, because you have to think how many times you have to do it. The trick is in this exponential. This exponential is significantly contributed by very improbable occasions when W is negative and large. When W is negative and large, so we are here. It's very improbable. It's improbable, but the exponential is huge. And a small probability at huge value gives you significant contribution, which is why you have to, for macroscopic system, you have to perform astronomical, not even astronomical number of experiments, even larger number than astronomical, and some people say biological numbers are bigger than astronomical. So you have to perform a super biological number of that. In single molecule experiments, you still have to perform it many, many times in order to catch these very improbable occasions. So it's not just a prescription to solve your difficulty to equilibrate the system. Okay. So I cannot finish this subject without mentioning quite famous papers by a friend of mine, Jeremy England, who you mentioned one of my students. So Jeremy England is in fact my grandson in scientific ways. And moreover, he is my grandson along two lines, because both his PhD advisor and his postdoc advisor were my students. So this is for population genetics, I think it's a little
That's all inbreeding. We talked about inbreeding depression, so we won't.
So what he did is a very welcome thing. He tried to generalize this very crux relation and to apply it very boldly to things like dividing cells and so on. I will not go into this because I think it would deserve a whole separate discussion, and maybe I'm not the best person to discuss it. I will just mention that if you read, and many of you I know do read, if you read his papers, then I encourage you to remember this figure, because what Jeremy did is he generalized Crookes' relation in a very tricky way. And I think it deserves much deeper scrutiny about the applicability conditions of all this. What is reversed, what is relaxed, and so I don't want to go deeper into that. I think it's very tricky and non-trivial questions, what is applicable, what is not applicable, but very interesting. Okay, so let me finish this and skip now to something else, which is Gibbs paradox, which is our next. I have half an hour, right?
Yeah, a little more.
Sorry?
I don't know, 10:30 at the latest.
Okay.
But are you going to talk about Maxwell's demon?
Yes, I will. But Maxwell's demon will be, in my understanding, Maxwell's demon and Gibbs paradox are closely related to one another.
I agree.
Gibbs paradox. I will start from Gibbs paradox. Gibbs paradox is the following. It was discovered by Gibbs himself, and I think around the year 1885, something like this. I don't remember exactly, so roughly 1885. By the way, Yale University is proud that Gibbs was the professor of Yale University. They but they do not tell you some small details. When he applied to Yale University, they said, oh, you work on such an uninteresting irrelevant stuff that we can only offer you a position without salary. So they never paid him. He was well off and he was not much dependent on the salary, but this is nevertheless. So, Gibbs paradox is the following. Imagine a volume divided into two halves, and you have some particles here and some particles there. And all of a sudden, you remove the divider. Then the thing, of course, will relax, come to equilibrium, in the sense that these particles will somehow mix. The question is, what is that? Since it relaxes, so we guess that entropy increases in this process. How much entropy increases? Okay, this is a really easy thing to do. And you know that entropy is proportional to the logarithm of concentration. So initial entropy will be like this. For each gas, and at the end, the entropy, so this is the initial, and this is final. Yeah. And if you take the difference, you see that this is n log 2 for every particle. And there is some contribution, some change of entropy. Oh, I forgot. Let me assume that Boltzmann constant is 1. I'm getting tired by putting Boltzmann constant everywhere. But Boltzmann constant is 1. By the way, keep in mind that Boltzmann constant was introduced by Planck, not by Boltzmann. And in fact, it was called for a while Planck constant. And then people got tired of two Planck constants to be precise. Planck himself suggested to rename this Boltzmann constant to try to have more radical suggestions. This is one. So then, what is the paradox? The paradox is if you imagine that these particles are the same, then what you will have is, if you imagine that they are the same, and you remove the divider, there is nothing to relax. It is already in equilibrium. Now, if you have relaxation, you don't have to redistribute your particles. It's already relaxed, so your delta delta S is 0. And then Gibbs asks, okay, so if I make my particles more and more alike, more and more similar, how does it happen that all of a sudden, from this quantity, which is large quantity, it is proportional to the number of particles. How does it happen that from large quantity I go straight to zero? This is paradox. This is called Gibbs paradox. And I think the resolution of this paradox is actually pretty easy. Unlike Loschmidt paradox, which is difficult and not completely resolved, I think that the resolution of this paradox is easy, and it is actually related to what I wrote here, and nobody noticed, not even Rob, did not you didn't recall when I said this is n divided by volume. When I always explain to my students that logarithm, that an animal does not eat food which has units. It suffers stomach aches if it is fed with things which have units. Units, you cannot do logarithm of units. So what did I mean? I have to include here, in fact, it should be V divided by some little v, some units. You need some units. And of course, these units will, what will happen if you rewrite this? You can change this little v maybe to something else, V prime, but then there will be this additive form. That means, because there is this strange little V under the log, that means there is arbitrary zero level for entropy. It should not surprise you too much, because, for instance, potential energy of something in the field of gravity is mgh, but h you can count from any place to any level. There is arbitrary zero level. Similarly, there is arbitrary level here. Yes.
Sorry, what is the little v prime? Is that for the second type of particle?
No. I am just saying that you can, since I did not tell you what it will be in the first one.
Oh, I see. You're just, okay.
I can add.
This is an identity of how to transform.
Yes, I can transform. I can write this formula with little. And by the way, this will not involve, this does not involve little v. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, any changes of entropy do not involve this arbitrary constant. In this sense, I can, and people frequently write without little v.
Well, that's rude.
This is rude, you know, for this logarithm. It's insult to the logarithm.
So what is a little v? Can you say that again? What is a little v?
Little v is an arbitrary quantity of the units of volume.
I'll interject. Do you remember when we did our lattice model and we had the little squares? That was what I called 1 over little v. That was C0. It happened to be 1 molar, actually.
And can you explain again why you put little v there and then you can solve the paradox?
No. To put this little v there will not solve the paradox at all. If I put the little v everywhere and do the subtraction, I write this formula exactly. And therefore, paradox is not solved at all.
Why should we put little v there?
Because otherwise, tell me what is logarithm of 1 cubic meter.
Like I could say log, if I could choose to use 10 to the 9th nanomolars, and he could choose to use 1 molar, we'd be talking about the same thing and we'd get different answers. That's really...
Different numbers.
Different groups, yeah. Not good.
Which is a normalization factor?
It's sort of like normalization factor, except for entropy, it is arbitrary zero level. Mm-hmm.
So I guess that the idea is that every time you have a transcendental function like a logarithm, an exponential, the argument must be a non-dimensional quantity, right? A pure number. So if you have, for example, log of 1 centimeter, then you must divide by 1 constant.
Yes.
Which, and in this case, you can do it because since you have various logarithm, you add several constants which overall cancel out. So you don't affect the whole formula, but the logarithm must have a pure number. Is that right?
Yes, this is right. If this is my final formula, then if you just go through algebra, take this, subtract this, imagine that every big V has little v going with it, subtract, you see that little v cancels away. It cancels away everywhere. And by the way, it is a good advice for you. If you do your calculation, and you discover that this V or C naught or some more, keep hanging out in your final result. What should you do? You should know for sure that you made a mistake. Your formula is wrong. Okay? If you take chemistry textbook will tell you, oh, this little V must be standard conditions, molar, millimolar, I never know what they suggest. But this is all trash. This is all the way to confuse people. This quantity is arbitrary, it should disappear at the end. Okay? And this is very important to understand. It means that absolute value of entropy is to some extent arbitrary. I will tell you briefly that there is some there is quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics tell you that fundamentally, at the end of the day, this V must be associated to this cube of the Broglie wavelengths of these particles and so on. But this is entirely ridiculous when you're talking about proteins or DNAs. To talk about the Broglie wavelengths of a protein is almost as meaningless as the Broglie wavelengths of me. I look here, I'm a rich man, I have the Broglie wavelengths. Nobody speaks enough. Okay? So the real prescription, when you do biophysics and macroscopic physics and so on, a real prescription, keep in mind that there is V, which must disappear at the end from all observable, as it disappears here. Why it is important to resolve the Gibbs paradox is because I think it emphasizes that Gibbs paradox is the issue of how you choose to consider your system. In other words, what you consider to be the macro states in your system. What do I mean by that? In quantum mechanics, there is a concept of indistinguishable particles. Quantum mechanics have profound effect on how we think about physics and so on, but the concept of indistinguishable particles is strictly quantum mechanical. When you are talking about macroscopic particles, such as, let's say, protein molecules, of course you can distinguish them. If nothing else, fundamentally, they probably two different protein molecules. They have different distribution of isotopes in their atoms. So you can distinguish them. Not to say that if you do molecular dynamics in your computer, you can, of course, distinguish everything from everything else. So, therefore, quantum mechanical resolution of this paradox, which is, by the way, written in many textbooks, and which says, oh, in quantum mechanics, there is no such thing as very similar particles. So they are either distinguishable or indistinguishable. It's not the case here in the real macroscopic world, biophysical world. It's not the case. You can very easily imagine particles which are similar, but not quite identical. Let's say proteins which are slightly different shape, same mass, but different shape. So then the question whether entropy of mixing will be like this or like this rests with the question, what is your experimental situation. Whether your experimental situation allows you to somehow distinguish these particles, or your experimental situation is such that it does not allow you to distinguish these particles. And for that, I printed out my favorite picture. I did not want to bring computer, but I printed out pictures. And I have three of them, so I have four of them. So you can just go and take a look.
Even if they're indistinguishable, even then I don't understand why the entropy should be zero, because there are much more ways. And there are much more states which are...
No, it's the same number of states. Yeah. This is... When you remove the divider, this particle, you want me to say that this particle can go or...
Yes,
but this particle, now that the divider is removed, this particle, you cannot distinguish it from this one. So it's the same thing. It's the same thing. You cannot say, oh, this particle has to go here. This particle is already there, because it's the same thing.
It's the same thing, but there are more times you're getting it. It's populated more number of times.
No, it's the same thing. You cannot say it's populated differently. It's the same thing. It's difficult to turn your head around this quantum mechanical weirdness. Two electrons are the same. That's it. You cannot say, oh, this electron. Same thing. In other words, maybe it's better to imagine that these quantum mechanical particles, they are not particles. You should imagine that instead of particles, you have some porridge, some fluffy thing that is everywhere. So you have your fluffy stuff on this side, fluffy stuff on the other side, it's all fluffy stuff. I ate, oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you. I forgot to tell you previous time, I forgot to tell you today. That previous time on my way here, I got parking ticket. Which is, I think, an interesting fact about statistical mechanics. 1 second. So, if you imagine a porridge, you have a divider, remove the divider, nothing changes. Still a porridge. Yes?
I think I'm having the same problem as Ramya. Isn't there now a conceivable state available where all the porridge is on one side after you remove the divider? Aren't there now states where all six of those balls are over on the left, which was not possible before you removed the divider?
It is a possible state, of course, when all these states are on the other side. This is, okay. When you compute entropy, you always obtain entropy which is additive, which is thermodynamically extensive. It is proportional to the number of parts. There are corrections to this, and corrections which are exponentially small. So what you are talking about is the exponentially small correction.
Okay.
And this extensive term, you know, okay. Okay, so.
I think you should have told the traffic office that you were in fact the same as the other person driving next to you with a certain equivalency there.
Thank you.
Therefore, you don't have to pay your ticket.
I will dispute parking tickets based on this idea. That's a good subject.
But like, you were telling us that you ate porridge and then you said, oh, and you forgot to tell us you got a ticket, but I still don't quite get it. What's the punchline?
The punchline was about the porridge.
Okay. Yeah, I just don't get why you told us about the ticket. Or is that just
that was just bad thing.
That was in my mind, the ticket that porridge was. Okay, so the point of this picture, which, yes.
I'm still confused about the last formula you put up because I mean you write that entropy is equal to a term is equal to the same term plus another term. How is that? Or am I missing something?
Okay. So imagine that somebody chose this V to be 1 nanometer cube, little V to be one nanometer cube, and somebody else chose 1 meter cube.
Okay.
So they are talking, these two people, talking about the same thing.
So the back thing is the normalization.
You can say that their answers must be the same except logarithm of the ratio of 1 nanometer cube to 1 meter cube.
Yeah.
And this arbitrary ratio plays the same role is arbitrary zero level of potential energy. Whenever you consider work that you need to do to raise something 1 meter, you take difference of potential energies at 2 levels. Whenever you consider anything observable, you have to take the difference between 2 entropies, this entropy and this entropy, and the difference will not include this term, will not include arbitrary. Similarly, when you consider this issue of similar or different particles, in my drawing, it is the difference between spherical particles and pill-like particles, you the difference in entropy is determined by whether your experimental equipment contains some elements which distinguish them. In my drawing, those are pistons, and these pistons are arranged such that you have this piston and this piston, and you have here particles of two different types, and particles of this type go back and forth through this piston without any problem, while particles of other type go through this piston without any problem. So then, if I move, if I push my pistons and move them close to one another, then I will achieve complete separation. How much work I will have to perform? Each piston will have to perform work P delta volume, and I have to do the sum running from volume V to volume 1/2 V, and pressure is ideal gas pressure, so it is given by N temperature divided by volume, V volume, from volume V to volume 1/2 V. And this work, as you see, is nothing else than NP log 2. And this is exactly this quantity. Okay? But if your particles penetrate through pistons back and forth with no difficulty, then that means you don't have to perform any work, and then you're... So, the answer to Gibbs' paradox is that you have to keep in mind the difference. You have to keep in mind that the distinguishability of your particles is the property of your experimental situation, is the property of your experimental setup. And therefore, that means the whole definition of entropy, what is entropy, depends entirely on your experimental setup.
Does that mean like entropy is not a very objective parameter? It's very subjective. It depends on how you define whether your particles are the same or not.
I would not call it subjective, but entropy, in the end of the day, entropy is a proxy for how much work you have to perform to go from one state to another. How much work you have to perform, it's not a subjective quantity, but it is a quantity which depends on experimental situation. With this apparatus, which has peculiar holes in the pistons, you have to perform one amount of work. With a different apparatus, you have to perform a different amount of work. Is that surprising? It's not surprising. Moreover, this points not to the weakness of entropy as a concept. It actually points to the strength of it, that it applies to much broader context of different situations than just elementary particles treated by quantum mechanics. And that, I think, is, so Rob, you will have to interrupt me at any point now. I'm obviously running out of time, so I will briefly tell you about the Maxwell demon, in the light of this discussion of entropy, which I think is really wrong. So just to be on the same page, Max Altman is, I think everybody knows it, but I will just mention that Maxwell Demon was invented by Maxwell in his private letter to Mr. Tate. And his letters to Tate, they were personal friends. They were boss quotes. And maybe because of that, maybe because of something else, they were personal friends and they were exchanging letters all their lives. And these letters are very interesting to read. Maxwell, in particular, half of those letters are rhymed, they are poetry. He liked to paraphrase Shelley in his letters, and I don't remember exactly how he formulated this Maxwell Demon story, but this was in the letter. The demon was invented in the letter. And the idea was to have an intelligent being which will sit at the door between two compartments, opening and closing this door, and this way, in the original formulation, it was the demon who would separate fast molecules from slower moving molecules. In my case, I would prefer to separate molecules of different types. So if you have initially a mixture of molecules of different types and you place a demon in the middle, well, the demon will allow black particles to go this way, white particles to go this way. Demon can separate them and then it can use my device to perform work. So the contradiction with Maxwell's demon, the idea was that this seems to contradict second law of thermodynamics in a very crude way, not like this one, which is exponentially improbable and so on, but in a very crude way. My understanding of resolution of this paradox, Maxwell-Demon paradox, has to do with the fact how this demon, the guy who sits at the door, how he collect information. He should watch the particles, and when particle arrives, demon is he or she? It. Does it work?
Yeah.
Intelligent it. So, it should close the door or open the door and so on. So the analysis goes this way. When it performs some measurement to find out what kind of particles of particle is arriving, it should have some internal memory. And for the time the particle still moves and approaches the door, the guy should still remember what he measured or it measured. So since there are only two types of particles, so memory of the demon, should be something of this sort. So this should be some sort of potential energy for the demon. And this is some sort of internal coordinate inside the demon memory, inside demon. Demon should be based on some neurons or some computer or I don't know what. There should be some coordinate inside the demon And if the daemon is in this state, it will open the door. If it is in this state, it will close the door. So there is some particle here, some sort. It's very generalized, of course, very approximate picture, but still, this is memory. This is how you should think of the memory of the thing. So now, if you have daemon with one unit of memory, then I will tell you what happens. But you can imagine a daemon which has many units of memory. So it memorizes first particle, second particle, third particle, keeps writing it down. And the point is, however big you can imagine a daemon, if you have a macroscopic amount of gas, then sooner or later, your daemon will write out of memory and will have to start erasing previous information from the memory. That's the point. And it suggests that if you have small amount of gas and large computer, then you can do it. I will tell you that if your memory of the daemon is restricted, while the amount of gas is large, then you cannot do it.
So what is the memory of the daemon?
What is the memory of the daemon? What is the memory of you? Mm-hmm. I don't know. But you probably remember many things, right?
So how does the memory of daemon can affect, I don't know, like?
Okay, so here is what happens. The daemon looks at this particular molecule and sees that it approaches the door. It needs to either close the door or open the door, right? The decision is based on whether the daemon sees black molecule or white molecule. And for the time between the act of measurement, when the daemon looks at the color of the molecule, and the time when it has to open or close the door, just to remember what the measurement was, right? So one way to remember is to have inside your head, to have such a two-state system. It may be electrical, it may be mechanical, it may be chemical, it may be. You have this type of system, and you put your particle here, and it says, keep the door open. That's the memory of the daemon.
So it has a certain way. Once you see some like specific particle, it knows how to move that thing.
Yes.
Okay. Then it can override that each time, right? It doesn't need to remember what it has done before. It just needs to be able to recognize the particles and know which it opened more quickly.
Yes, it only needs to remember it for a very short time.
But then why would it blast the memory of the computer? It doesn't need to remember what it has done in the past.
Okay, that's fine. It doesn't need to remember it for a very long time, but it needs to remember it for a short time.
Yeah.
So for a short time, so it remembers it for a short time, and then, okay, this particle is over, then next particle. Mm-hmm. How do we proceed if there is next particle? We have to erase information which, that's all. That's all I'm telling you. You have to erase the information of previous part. If you were to have two units of memory, you could remember the first particle, then second, but then when third particle arrives, you have to erase the first.
But in order to do its task, the daemon doesn't need to know what it did the first or second time.
No, absolutely. If the simplest daemon will have only one unit on memory, and will have to erase it every time.
Well, I think what they're driving at, which you haven't exactly said yet, is that it actually costs free energy to erase.
But that's I am about to say, yes.
Yeah. And then we're going to have to stop. That's...
Okay.
Is so overwriting the same as erasing? Why would be overwriting more energy costly than just writing a new unit? That's
okay. I will have to tell you exactly what Rob said, that erasing this information costs free energy. Better to say it costs dissipation of KT log 2. This amount of energy has to dissipate into an environment. Then epsilon dissipation. To erase 1 unit of memory, this is how you have to, this is how much you have to work in order to dissipate, to forget 1 unit of information. This log 2, invite you to realize that this is the same log 2 as here. So that means in order to perform its function, your daemon will have to, in order to put one particle in conscious way from one side to the other, this is at least how much energy it will have to perform. It will need to spend. At least this amount of work it will need to perform to erase its memory. And this is exactly the amount of work you need to perform with my stupid two-piston system. So all this intelligence of the daemon will not help it at all. Will he need to perform this exact amount of work at these two pistons with different shapes of their hole? Same thing. This is called Landauer principle, and I don't have time to explain it better, except I will tell you that people measured it. And there are several groups in the world who measured it. I happen to like the work by the man called Sergio Chiliberto. And what he did is he used optical tweezers to create memory unit like this with colloidal particle and to see how much energy dissipate to erase 1 bit of information. And that is this amount. So this was measured, and I don't have time to explain how it was measured, but it was measured, and so I encourage you to take a look. So, this is it. Thank you.
Thanks. All right, I need to just say a few things. So tomorrow, I think some people are going to the Channel Islands. And I think we're still a little disorganized. Like I looked this morning online and I saw that people are going. And I don't know who gave money to JD or whatever. I don't know anything, actually, about anything. Other than that, there's a bunch of people that say they're going and there's a bunch of people that say they're willing to drive. So I kind of am hoping that you guys today will send out a mail giving instructions about boat times, what we should bring. And then the ride part, I need to know if I need to drive up to Santa Barbara. I'm going to be in Carpinteria, so it'll be it's a big issue for me, but I'm happy to do it. So that's one thing. The other thing is, Amy, my wife, kindly just went and got a bunch of beer and snacks. And so I'm hoping somebody will ride with us in the car that can open the lab so we can put all the stuff in there. That's my announcements. Does anyone else have anything they want to say, Shelley or Mike? Does anyone know anything about tomorrow? Okay.
I know something. Okay. The sun will rise in the morning, yeah. And the sun will set at about 8 o'clock in the evening.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
I like it.
And I want to go.
We'll go with that. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to sweat too much about tomorrow, but if somebody doesn't communicate something, I'm probably just going to ask JD for my money back.
I think JD tried to contact people there, but he wasn't successful until yesterday.
Ah. So is it happening?
It's happening, but he just cannot contact Greg.
Okay. Well, so anyway, thanks again.
And I think some of the people who are signed up online are not actually going. Like,
No, but they're
I'm not going.
There's an updated sheet that people fill in their information. I think there are still more than 10.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of people on the sheet.
Okay. Well, anyway, does somebody want to go with me that can just win the lap?
I'll go. I need to be there.
Maybe
you need someone with a key, right?
What?
Oh, yeah, we need someone with a key.
But how does it get open in the first place?
Pick up a key, though.
Well, so hopefully the keys are open.
Magic. Uh-huh. I just go there and it's open.
Hopefully it'll be open. Yeah. If not, I guess I'll figure something out.
So, I like all this. I like to understand that one way has to be money for so the way I understand it is that the thermodynamics of this system depends only on the amount of information that I have and on the free energy that I spend right on my memory or erase on my memory, regardless of the way this is made. Is this right? So, in what way Maxwell-Dimon increased our knowledge? Okay. Maxwell-Dimon paradox was easily solved when Maxwell said, I can have this demon that violates the spirit law. The paradox is solved by knowing that the entering consumption of this system plus this system satisfies the second law. So the real step was the step that was made then, the connection with the information. That's the real new part.
If you want,
erasing the information in my memory.
I guess, yeah, my feeling of this, someone, all right, I'm not sure. The thing that's coming to my mind right now, which I don't know if this is wrong. I don't know, I've gotten really, to me, I've sort of convinced myself that, you know, the whole notion of entropy depends on some scheme. And that depends on deciding what's the same and what's different. And that's the sort of an observer choice, I guess. And so I guess I would totally agree with that statement. It's about the observer.
I don't disagree there.
Because even if we talk about the entropy of particles in a box, we're defining a certain macro stage for that, and that's a choice we've made, because all the micro states are actually equally likely. And so, without a choice, it's macro state, so there is no good choice. Well, this is the entropy of the probability distribution of micro states.
Okay.
We have many entropies in a big
in every...
Right, yeah. Yeah, but I'm not sure exactly what your question is, but I would say first that, like, there is an important issue of, like, sameness of points. That is a crucial thing. It's just, like, right. And that's the point.
Whether make it a problem.
Science is useful.
Now it seems like we always think of making it same.
Right.
I guess.
No, so actually, so one of the problems that's been interesting for a while is what happens to entropy. So say, forget real, you know, real world. Like a real abstract problem. Like, I have a problem. Now I can force grain that by saying, like, this bin of X is here, is this bin of X is here, is another thing, this bin of X is here. So now when I force grain, I get another probability distribution of that. Like, I'm kind of a Shannon entropy here, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the entropy has to.
So this, I'm not trying to say. So you're saying the size of the memory must be greater than the size of my task, otherwise, I cannot get information.
Right. Say it's just a uniform distribution, and I have n possible values, so the iteration is larger. So now I go to three possible values, so I'm bending things together. Now I know
if the size of the memory is smaller than, because I need to grasp information.
And so this always has to be true. Like you have to, as I force grain, I'm always
going
to
just get
entropy will always be increasing.
Yeah, so
my question
is,
I don't know,
also include.
So one last question. So people write I n such things. They are.
Well, that's the thing I've wondered is there any general principle for all the information?
Now, is this the way
we know it's an increase? And right now I don't know any answer. I would just all I can say is like you have to whenever we talk about the entropy of something, we have to just be explicit about what the coarse grain is. Yeah, and it's like a discrete thing about
that's my initial question.
Yeah, I agree, and I don't have an answer. I guess basically it's something I'm worried about too, and I don't have an answer to.
Okay, but it's good to know at least there is someone else worried about.
Yeah, so I think about this now in the context of evolutionary
flexibility. Oh, interesting. Okay.
So for me, for me, entropy is the natural. You have all your process, all mine, I think that's the natural.
It's entropy the natural way to see the so-called concerns and like no matter if it's
right. Well, that's the thing, because now what that entropy will be depends on how we're defining what's the same and what's different. So in sequence space, two trajectories might be different because they went through different phase permutations. But in the phenotype space, they may have the same phenotypic type and they may look the same. And then
so entropy degradation, the difference in entropy degradation, the difference between scientific space and phenotypic space kind of is analogous to the different force training.
It's not analogous, it's a manifestation of that problem. It's a particular example of it. Yeah,
sure. But in evolutionary
time. Yeah. Well, this is my observation
of the field. I was thinking about express as a fluctuation theory. Because when the number of degrees of freedom is not given, then the fluctuation is not so that they don't understand the given by the discrimination
itself. So this is structure.
However, the Maxwell theorem is this field,
which is unknown.
And then the fluctuation theorem is rewriting this as a ratio.
Sometime in the future. They think
making
relationship.
A lot of this stuff is quite new, right?
Well, so the idea is that's not
even if you have a genetic. I can write down a model. I'd love the
entropy. The thermodynamics can be written in this way.
Where we talk about evolutionary predictability, we have to talk about this.
The only thing that
matters is say whether we want to discuss whether it's predictable or not, we have to say like at what level.
And the free energy.
Okay, then the question is, if, for example, if the predictor is on the scientific space, is totally real, and also if the
man is
this is a principal relationship,
then do you consider this
thinking
evolution of phenotypes?
Yes, yes. So the problem in the thermodynamics space will account for both.
Well, if it's predictable, the phenotype is always a coarse grain phenotype, so it should be as bad.
Yes. So,
memory.
To me, like that's not the likely scenario. Evolution is rather unpredictable at the genotypic level.
Exactly.
The phenotypic level might actually
some
be
the reaction happen by reading the state of the system. And
yes,
if the reaction is state, then the reaction.
But statistically,
I think we know it has to be because there's some degeneracy among genotypes. Like,
yes.
Certainly there are lots of genotypes that
but
can
I would say, like, the conformation position of the enzyme is a sort of
that
disappears, right?
I think you're wondering then, is phenotype
so maybe the
whole
thermodynamics can
lead to
a sort of I, which accounts for how many enzymes are in a certain position.
It's fine.
So the entropy will always be decreasing, non-decreasing
from genotype.
Yes, as you go from genotype to
phenotype.
But the question is, how strong is that bound? Like, how big is the genotypic entropy in sequence space? You know, because that's your upper bound, zero is your lower bound. So if they're very close, then that's a pretty strong constraint on phenotypic evolution. That's like what you're saying, where if genotypic evolution is pretty predictable, then that's all you really need to know.
So you won't
do it for shame. Entropy is fixed, but I suspect the Batchman, probably realistic evolution is that's a big.
So you want to
derive from predictability levels.
But I guess my question is. Going back to the thermodynamics, that I wonder whether we also should define how we do this coarse grain.
Exactly. That's what's
probabilistic mapping way.
That's cool because
how likely you will have
one,
how likely you will have a mapping two.
I don't know. Well, I don't know how to do. I think it's a choice. I don't know how you can do that. Like I say, what's the coarse graining I want to do for this model? Like, what do I count the same? What do I count as different? I don't know how you can.
I guess it's just subjective comfort zone different. I guess I'm not comfortable with.
I'm not saying I'm comfortable with that, but I don't see any way not
because
to
I hate subjective.
Yeah, but I feel like I don't see any way around that because that's like saying what I think what he said here was the right way to say it, which is like what experiment I'm going to do. It's like what am I actually going to measure?
I guess that's also
measuring is always a choice about what's the same and what's different. Things that have that only differ in things I did measure are the same.
That's an implicit assumption we made all the time.
So I guess the only thing I've kind of come to feel about it is like you have to be explicit about all those things. So like this issue with evolutionary predictability, I guess maybe my only answer to it is right now is that you just whenever you're going to talk about evolutionary predictability, you have to be specific at what level you're talking about that at. Because you can't talk about it in general because it's different depending on what level of how coarse grained description you're
equation to use. Mm-hmm.
Do they have other
schedules? I guess not.
Okay. X equals 1. So you perform certain operations, computational operation, which is completely reversible. If X equals 1, you can make this conclusion, but you can also make this conclusion. It's reversible. You can go back and forth logically. It is equivalent. Now imagine that you solve a different equation, x squared equals 1. And you claim that the solution is x equals 2y. This is irreversible logically, because what you did is you lost one solution. Right? So this is logically irreversible. So it turns out that in order to perform on a computer logically irreversible operations, you have to force your computer to go through thermodynamically irreversible process. It's very interesting that thermodynamic irreversibility and logical irreversibility are connected to one another.
Sorry, I don't understand why they can connect.
Why they
connect to each
other. Do you understand that this is logically irreversible? So a reversible operation will be x squared equals 1, then you can reversibly go to x equals plus or minus 1. And then there is irreversible step to say that x equals 1, which means your array is x equals minus 1. So this is the erasure. You have to erase it. Erasure requires work. Erasure requires dissipation. You have to dissipate. For the computer working at the non-zero temperature T, you have to erase, you have to dissipate. Four logically irreversible steps. If you do only logically irreversible steps, for instance, you take, I don't know, my name, Alexander, and write it from right to left, and from left to right, and you do it many times, does not require any irreversible operation. Okay. Thank you.